My stubbornness led me to a high security federal prison with 1,000 women in Oakland, California. And I walked in, and there aren't words to describe the heartbreak I felt, just the absolute devastation of leaving my community, my husband, my children, and how I couldn't even imagine how I was going to get through a day, a week, a year. And I had a 7-year sentence hanging over my head.
This episode is brought to you by Pause, Breathe, Reflect, the app that can help bring more mindfulness to your everyday moments. Imagine what would be possible if more people could live more mindfully. Hey there, my fellow like-hearted humans. It's Michael, and this is the Kintsugi Podcast. This week, get ready for a wonderful story of connection. We'll start here. There are not many certainties in the world, but here's one. If the FBI comes to your house looking for you, you know it's not a good moment. And that's exactly what happened to this week's guest. They were looking for her. Weeks later, in a federal court, she was sentenced to 84 months in prison, 7 years. She had to leave behind her husband and her kids. Before the FBI paid her a visit, she was getting after it, striving, doing the hustle and grind thing, flipping houses, trying to be like an HGTV personality. But her ways caught up with her, and she was sent off to prison. It was an experience that would break many of us, and it broke our guest. But what she discovered while she was in prison was a way to heal, to fully connect, and connect with her fellow inmates. What she saw was that their stories were in her story, and vice versa. She realized that indeed we are all connected. We are all one. She took, using my language, a last bad day moment, and now she's using the energy from that to help others heal, to help others connect, and help us all look at prison life differently. Yes, there are plenty of people in prison who have committed horrific crimes, and they're paying their price for their actions. But there are many people in prison, maybe all people in prison, that are dealing with transgenerational trauma, the hurt that has never been healed. And as they say, hurt people, and healed people help heal people. What our guest is now doing is helping us see those in prison. So instead of looking at them as the other, we can see that our stories are within each other. So we can connect, all of us, as we go through life. So if you're ready, I invite you to take a healthy breath in and a nice, slow, releasing breath out. And get ready to hear Portia Lauder's story on how she's helping us heal and become more connected in our Kintsugi spirit. Hey, Portia, good to see you.
It's great to be here, Michael.
I can't wait for our conversation. Your story, when I think of Kintsugi, your story is a perfect match, and there's going to be so much that we get to dive into. And I know up front, as we just mentioned, there'll be a whole bunch that we won't get to, but you have two amazing books that I'll encourage people to pick up once we get done with our conversation. But let's start here. How is your central nervous system doing at this moment?
I feel pretty calm today. Yeah.
Good. All right. That's good. We like that. All right. But if it was something different, that would be totally cool as well.
Yeah.
So my wife and I love a good, how did you meet connection story?
Okay.
So I know Chad, your husband, is obviously plays a major role in your life with your family and through your story that we'll get into. But I would love for you to share how you and Chad met.
I always tell people we must have met before we came to Earth and then we connected here.
Oh, I love
But
that.
because there's just no other explanation for the commitment that we feel to each other. But in this life, my sister was going to college with my husband. Her fiance and my husband were college friends. So she was engaged. And then she introduced me to my husband, Chad. And her fiance broke it off. They didn't end up getting married. And then Chad and I ended up getting married. So it's kind of a twist. But I do remember the first time I met Chad, and the thing that my life wasn't, I wasn't in a great place in my life, but I remember thinking, there's so much kindness and goodness in this man. I wish my life were different because he's somebody I would really want to spend a lot of time with. And somehow it worked out that we ended up married, which is such a blessing for me. And he'd probably say the same, but especially for me. So
I think he would say the same. I'm gonna make a bet, Portia, and say he's gonna say the same. I love that. Sort of, I always love how people meet. You know, there are people coming into our lives all the time. The universe or higher power, it works in mysterious ways to put people in front of us. And as we take our vows, the traditional vows, right, through sickness and in health, good times and bad times, richer or poorer, you know, we say, most people say these things, these vows, and they're like, oh yeah, it's gonna be easy for us, and we won't have to worry about the sickness part or, you know, the financial hardship part or any of the bad moments, because for us, our marriage is going to be easy peasy lemon squeezy. And then one gets married and you learn that it's a little bit harder. And certainly it's been hard for both of you. So I would love for us to dive into your story by starting in 2015. So it's February 16th. You're in the courthouse. And I was hoping you could bring us to that moment. What's happening for you, and really not just you, but your whole family, including Chad.
So that day was the culmination of years of dealing with a federal investigation. I was involved in some real estate transactions that were illegal, and had been battling that, battling myself is really what I, when I look back and think about it. I mean, when you come to understand who the federal government is, but not even just the federal government, I feel like whenever you're up against a challenge, it's mostly you're up against yourself. And that was the case. But it became crystal clear for me that later on that I had always been battling myself. But at this point, walking into a federal courthouse is one of the more sterile experiences of your life. If this is connection, that is the opposite of connection. There's just a, it's sterile. And it's also, if you've been through the legal system, there's a lot of pain. There's a lot of denial. There's a lot of frustration because it's never, you know, it's never just clean cut. Well, typically. And the day that I walked into that courthouse, my situation became very clear to me. A few things. Number one, that I was going to get the maximum sentence that the judge could give me. I could see my situation much clearer, that I had made some really bad choices. I felt devastated about the pain that I caused my family. And I don't know why up to that point, it wasn't as clear, probably because I was so preoccupied with trying to fight and defend myself. But all of a sudden I could see, what have I done to this man that I love? And to my children that are all sitting there next to him. And then I have made everyone angry. I mean, this judge is angry, the prosecutor's angry, and even on the best day, if I hadn't made everyone angry, it's not a place of mercy and compassion. I mean, it's a very sterile, just, this is the United States and this is Portia Lauder. And it was overwhelming, you know, the sorrow I felt, the shock. And I knew, I remember looking back at my husband and children, and I knew this is going to take a really long time. I never want to feel that level of sorrow again for the mistakes that I made. It was devastating. So,
So thanks for sharing that. You know, when I read in your book, for me as the reader, it was a collection of emotions, you know, really heavy emotions, as, you know, I try to put myself in your shoes, in your family's shoes. So you did an excellent job in writing about that period of time. That's sort of how your book starts.
Starts out, yeah.
So let's go back. You mentioned it was a culmination of a lot of different mistakes.
Right.
So can you share more about how you grew up and like some of those, I guess, experiences, those mistakes that led to that moment?
Sure, yeah. So I live in Utah, and I am the oldest of seven children, and I grew up kind of on the outskirts of a small town. Our family was pretty non-traditional for Utah. My mom was like a super hippie, very loving and compassionate, but my dad was a Vietnam vet with PTSD. And so the lack of structure was frustrating for him. I think I was probably a little frustrated too, even though there were so many beautiful things about the way I was raised. You know, I loved the creativity. There was a lot of connection between me and my siblings and my parents. But by the time I was 12 or 13 years old, I was, first of all, very stubborn. I had decided I was going to do what I was going to do. And because I had really hadn't had any boundaries, it was like, good luck trying to instill them now, you know? And also, I pretty much decided that what boys thought of me was the most important thing. So it was just this need of external validation at that point.
Yeah, you need someone to complete you.
Correct, right. And that led to difficult teenage years. I mean, I started dating boys that were much older. I think I was 13 and they were 16. And then it just continued to progress. I guess I thought I was pretty fearless, but I was just willing to do anything at any time to have a good time. And by the time I was 17 years old, I was pregnant with my first child. And so I moved out of my parents' home and I moved into a low-income apartment. I was on welfare and started trying to raise my son and provide. And I was just so young, you know. And again, thinking, well, if I just get married, I just need to find somebody that will take care of me. Everything will be okay. And so I did. I got married to someone much older than me. He was 10 years older than me and had no idea. I knew him a month when we got married. His offer was, hey, I'll take care of you if you marry me. So it wasn't true love.
No, it was a transactional endeavor. So you're
right
at this point in time. I just want to check us on this. You're 17.
Right.
You're a mom of one child. This man of 27 comes and says, hey, let's get hitched. I'll take care of you. And you're coming from a place of, I still need someone to complete me because I don't, the way you're talking to yourself is that you're not enough. So there's something missing.
Correct.
And it must be a man. A man's missing. And so this transaction sounds pretty decent.
Right. Yeah. And it wasn't great, as you can imagine. I mean, a 17-year-old marrying guy, it wasn't going great.
As a father of two daughters, Portia, like for me, like reading through this part of it was like, oh my gosh, you know, like, and this is no judgment on your dad. Just, you know, just for me as a dad is just like, holy cow. It's a world that I didn't experience when they were going through their teenage years. So you brought me into your world, and I, you know, there's an empathy and a connection that I had reading through these early years. So again, as I mentioned up front, like, thanks for sharing this, because it does start to paint a picture of like what was happening upstream that led to that day in federal court.
Yeah. You know, my poor dad, I mean, he used to call me the freight train that wouldn't stop. He's like, you just keep going and going, you know? He's like, I wish you could just stop. And I love my dad. He's amazing, but my kids will say, who was your hardest child? Portia. Who was the hard, always Portia, because I was so stubborn, you know? So, yeah. But anyway, those years were difficult. I lived outside this little town, and it was so very small that I had never been on an airplane, never been to the city. I mean, you have to imagine when, you know, the capital of where you live is about 5,000 people. And so the outskirts was, you know, just out in the country. And so about, I don't know how much after I got married, my dad got transferred for work to the city in Utah, which is Salt Lake City. And I had never been there. Yeah. And it was kind of an awe-inspiring moment for me when I drove up with my son to visit my parents for the first time and thought, wow, like I just left this little town. There's like a whole world out here. Maybe I could have a life. I could get a job. Something could be different. I went back and I told my husband, I want to go to the city and get a job. And he was like, oh, I'm never leaving this town. Yeah, you're on your own. Go ahead. Let's get divorced.
Oh, wow. So like, he was like, no, small town life is for me. You want to be a big city girl. And I live outside of New York City. So for me, Salt Lake is like a place, or Park City would be a place that you would go vacation to.
Right, right.
And so, which then just underscores that everything is relative. Right. So he's like, no can do. Oh, yeah. I ain't moving. Not leaving. Just as a point of reference, how small was your small town? Do you remember the population?
Yeah, I would say 5,000 to 8,000 was the population, but I had been living outside of that town. I had moved into the town in a low income apartment. And so when I came to, you know, Salt Lake City, it was the city for me. It was the biggest city I'd been to.
Biggest city. Yeah. So they have sports franchises and entertainment and restaurants and like all, the whole shebang and, you know, the beautiful
It just
mountains.
Looked like lively. It looked lively. And I thought, you know, there's a different life for me. Like I don't belong in this town.
Yeah. There's an energy to the city. That's like, like I can tell with your energy, like I'm going to eat this up. This is going to be amazing.
That's exactly what
So here comes Portia to the big city of Salt Lake. Then what happens?
Well, I got a job, but I found out I was pregnant shortly after I moved. So, you know, here I am now, I think 20 years old, and I have a child, and I'm pregnant with my second child. And I called my ex-husband, but he didn't want to be a part of it. And I just remember I was really lonely. It was just a lonely time. I was working and that was good, but it just, I felt very alone. It was a difficult time. So.
And still feeling in that state of loneliness, this feeling of like, you're still not complete is probably with you. And then from there, so you're in this spot of loneliness. Mm-hmm. How did you get into real estate and that aspect of your life?
Well, a lot happened before that, but I'll speed it up because it's a lot. My main career was a photographer. That's what I was doing at the time. I was a single mother for a while, and then I ended up meeting my husband, Chad, and when we got married, I had a pretty good shot at building a new life, you know, and I recognized that was, I had also struggled with addiction. There were lots of things that kind of led me to this place where I wanted something different. And that was about the time I met Chad. And honestly, I was done thinking that men were going to solve my problem because I had tried multiple times with relationships that hadn't worked out and started focusing on myself. And got sober and started working on being a better parent. And then I met my husband. And Chad's pretty amazing. He really is. He had just graduated college. He had his life in front of him, a good life. And my life was kind of chaotic. And we got married and started building a life together. And I built a company. It was Photography by Portia. Started out doing 20 or 30 weddings a year. And within a few years, because I do have that energy of go, 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 well, first of all, I had two more kids with him, which is just what I seem to do.
Bam, bam, bam. Hey, one of seven, Portia. Now you're having four kids.
I know.
And again, just from a timeline perspective, you meet Chad. You guys are in your early 20s.
Later 20s. Later 20s. Later 20s. Yeah. And
but as we would say in New York, Chad would be considered a mensch, because I don't know a lot of guys who have the maturity to say, hey, I'm in my 20s. I've met someone. She already has a family. And right. I want to sign up for this. So this, again, universe bringing you guys together. And right. one thing I want to share with all the listeners, if you believe that you need someone to complete you, I will say, no, you don't, because you are already complete. And, right. you know, and that's a lesson that we all, I think, face at one point yeah. or another in our lifetime. And you had to learn this lesson that you didn't need another person to complete you. You are already complete.
And that's been one of the longest journeys. I mean, I have arrived at that place, but boy, I think it's such an important thing to come to know who you are, what your worth is, and who you are just by yourself before, you know.
Yeah, but it's a connection piece of like connection with who you are. That's like,
right.
Once you get there, that is powerful juju.
It's so powerful. Yeah, it really is. So yeah, I mean, Chad's amazing. I think he was intimidated, obviously, to take on children and stuff, but he loved me and he was great to the kids. He adopted my kids and we started building this life. And I mean, my photography business just really boomed. It really grew. And Chad had a career as well. And I had the two more children and then started building a new home. And it was mostly because I wanted to put this photo studio in the home, but my business was growing so fast, I ended up doing a separate studio and the home. And about that time, real estate, I mean, this is 2004, 2005, and in this country, real estate just went wild. In fact, in my neighborhood, lots had doubled in less than 6 months in value. The price, like, they went from, I think, $60,000 to $120,000 to buy a lot. So I'm like, I'm in, you know. My parents were entrepreneurs. I'm thinking, I'm gonna invest. I'm gonna pay off our home. I'm gonna set myself up, and now I won't have to have nannies taking care of my kids while I'm running my photography business. And it all just made sense. My parents always bought and sold real estate. It's like, I'll just jump into this. And in the beginning, that's what it was. I was in way over my head. I mean, I have learned the value of balance, and I've learned that money is just not worth as much as we think it is. Like, there's other things that are so much more valuable, like peace of mind and time. But I was in over my head. And about that time, I had a back surgery and I relapsed, started using prescription drugs again. And when I see, my brain is different. I mean, I know some people can take an opiate for pain, but the second I do, my brain goes, oh, this is the way you're supposed to feel. This is the real you. And I make terrible choices because I get so aggressive. Like, my nature is aggressive. So I'm not just using these pills now. I'm hustling. I'm buying and selling. Yeah.
The adrenaline is kicking in.
Yeah.
You're exactly. just going to warp speed. And around that period of time, that's when the whole house flipping boom yep. really happened, right? People were flipping houses. HGTV yep. was on fire because everyone wanted to learn how to do this to make a quick buck.
Right.
And so you fell into that.
Yeah. Absolutely. I thought, I'm going to get a piece of it. I'm not getting left out, you know?
Absolutely. This is easy yeah. money. Like, right. like, buy a house, do a little reno,
yep.
sell the house, make some profit, take the profit, buy the next big house. It yeah. seemed pretty simple.
Yeah, it wasn't. It got really complicated. Started out like that, but yeah. So, you know, I get into it a few years into it, and I have a whole subdivision under contract. I'm trying to build new construction homes, and I have, you know, money going here and money going there. And then equity deals, which means that you take a house, borrow more, you take a home equity line of credit, more money against the house than it's even worth. And then you flip it and you use that money to buy something else. It's pretty much a real estate Ponzi scheme. And that's what I got involved in were those types of deals. And, you know, I remember when the FBI showed up, so scary. Nobody wants them to come to their house. I promise. It's terrible.
Yeah, never it's definitely a day you're going to remember. The FBI ringing the doorbell. or knocking or whatever they do. You're never gonna forget that moment.
Yeah, it was sickening. I still remember, as you say that, it was pretty sickening. Yeah, it's awful. So
in that moment, they're there. Chad's probably there, and they say, "Hey, listen, you're in trouble. You're in trouble, lady. We're taking you in." And Chad is your husband. Probably has to make a decision because he probably has some knowledge of what's happening. Like, will he cooperate and all that? So they pull you away.
Mm-hmm.
We'll fast forward a little bit to, again, going to the courthouse, the federal courthouse. They sentence you to 7 years, and they send you off. If I have my memory set, they send you off to a high security prison.
That's right. Yep. A federal prison.
Yeah. Which is the highest level, right? If I know prison staging, if you will, or security levels, which I'm not an expert on by any means, but in essence, this was a white collar crime, if you will.
Right. Right.
And here they send you off. They sentence you to the maximum sentence. 84 Correct. Months or seven years.
7 years. Mm-hmm.
A high security prison, which, again, I can't fully comprehend why they would do that, but maybe you can shed some light on that. So can you bring us then up to this early part of your prison life? You know, because now four kids, husbands left behind, probably in financial difficulty because of all this and paying all the lawyers and all that jazz. And can you bring us to this period of your life?
Yeah. Yes. All of that. It was, financially devastating. Everything. We just lost everything. I fought, hired lawyers, and, my children, the saddest part is really just that they grew up with this stuff hanging over their head because it went on for years. And then by the time I finally walked into prison, Chad made the choice to stand by me, which brought about an indictment for him, which was a conspiracy charge, right? Because he was there and he wasn't involved in those deals, but being aware of a deal is the same. So they hit him with a conspiracy charge. And the day I was sentenced, I was given 8 weeks to say goodbye to my family and get my affairs in order. And that was shocking to me to leave the courthouse and be, my whole view shifted to really recognize how foolish I had been to trade something as valuable as time and connection for money. Like, it just seemed like, how could I have traded everything I care about, my children, all these beautiful moments, I traded for what, you know? And the last 8 weeks I spent just watching my children sleep and driving them to school and sharing every tender moment, lots of tears. And the day came where he drove me to a federal prison in California because they don't have them in Utah. And so I went, we drove 14 hours and I walked into a prison in Oakland, California, and it was high security. So there was about 1,000 women. I was expecting to go to a camp. They put a management variable on me, and I think it was, I don't know, you know, it actually worked out in my favor. I just made everybody mad because I'm stubborn. I pretty much asked the FBI to take a lie detector test.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't humble at all.
So you've changed a lot, Portia, but not from the stubbornness that your father would say that you were growing up, right? So that's still a thread that's part of who you are. And it probably has helped you in so many ways to be gritty, and that stubbornness probably helped you as you served your time.
You know, that's such an interesting view because I believe it did. I mean, my stubbornness helped me say, I don't care what people think about me. I don't care if people think you go to prison, you're a bad person. I'm not going to let that define me. So my stubbornness gave me strength. But what I do is every day I say these words to myself, you are flexible, Portia, you are flexible. You know, I work on, and then I also believe that my integrity and honesty with myself and others keeps me safe. Like, I take accountability so that I don't give people power to put me in places like prison or, you know, it's interesting. We think prison is an external thing, but it's an internal thing too. There's a lot of people in prison out here. And so I don't want to be in more so an internal prison. Put me in a prison, I can be at total peace. By the end of my sentence, I was. But if you give me an internal prison, if I imprison myself, it's really hard to get out of that. So,
oh, absolutely.
But yeah, it was, so my stubbornness led me to a high security federal prison with 1,000 women in Oakland, California. And I walked in, and there aren't words to describe the heartbreak I felt, you know, just the absolute devastation of leaving my community, my husband, my children, and how I couldn't even imagine how I was going to get through a day, a week, a year. And I had a 7-year sentence hanging over my head. What I was surprised at was the kindness of these other women. You know, I sat at a table next to a woman and I couldn't even breathe because I cried so hard. And she just said, honey, keep breathing. Just breathe. It's going to go away. It'll get better. I don't even know her name, but she, here's a woman who had suffered like I had and who was saying, we got you. We're with you. This will pass. We're right here. Like that to me, you know, would you do that with a stranger on the street? I mean, how beautiful is that, that somebody sitting there who doesn't know me at all would show me that kind of compassion? I had a cellmate right away that could see that I wasn't doing well. And she kept saying, Portia, you've got to get out of the cell. You've got to go to the kitchen. They're going to put you in a suicide cell. It's going to get worse for you, you know? And I just kept saying, just please go away. She'd bring me an apple in the morning. It's okay. Here's something to eat. Like, you're going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And I think the compassion right away that I was shown was surprising to me. But the heartbreak, I know why people get angry in prison. I know why they feel the way they do, because it'll break you. It's very painful to walk through that, you know? And it was a surprise to me that I could live and hurt as deeply as I did. So,
yeah. So I imagine you went into prison, much like any of us, with an attitude or a belief about what prison was going to be like.
Yeah.
Watching movies or TV. And what I discovered when I rode my bike across the country in 2022, and I rode through the rural part of America from Oregon to Washington, D.C. So I didn't go through any big cities. Probably the biggest city I actually touched was Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. So I went through a lot of rural areas, and I was amazed by how many prisons I rode near.
Yeah.
And it made me reflect, because I had a lot of time on my bike to reflect on this. But
sure.
I think we put a lot of prisons outside the main street view. Away. We're going to put these people away, out of sight, out of mind. Right. We will other them. They're bad people.
Right. Yeah.
And certainly in our prison system, there are people who have committed horrific crimes.
Sure.
But in your writing, you share a lot about how some people arrived in prison from years of trauma when they were younger and using drugs to numb their pain, which then led to dealing drugs and other crimes.
Right.
And so you mentioned just a second ago about the kindness that was given to you by complete strangers.
Yeah.
In this moment, how else did your view of who is in prison change from maybe how your perspective before you arrived? Because again, my hunch is it wasn't too different than what many of us feel like. These are bad people. They have to,
pay the price.
Their time, pay for their crime. They're there. Well, other
right.
So what was that experience like for you?
Well, first of all, I mean, why do you think I was willing to fight to the death and spend every dime we had not to go to prison? Because I really was. In my mind, I'm thinking, if I go to prison, it's like death for me. It's like moral death. Only bad people go to prison. I can't go to prison. How do you ever recover from that? Because I didn't know. I had no idea that I would meet these kind, strong, traumatized, amazing people that would become my dear friends. And as I came to know them and understand them, I came to know myself and found so much more beauty in who I am. I didn't know. I had no idea. If people knew what I know, you can't go work with this population without, because the gratitude that they show, the love that they show, because so many of them are so have depleted of that. They don't have it in their lives. If your parents were in prison and your grandparents were in prison, or you were raised by drug addicted parents who were also, I mean, this is generational trauma that people don't understand. And when they get a chance, I taught classes. Can I take your class, Miss Louder? Can I please take your class? I mean, it just was so different than I thought, how desperate people are to want to learn and grow and change. And yeah, they've made mistakes. But people out here make mistakes. I mean, I worked with a whole lot of people in real estate that I would trust less than the people that I met in prison, you know? So I don't know. It just, my whole view shifted, and I would never undo that experience to have I love the view I have. My understanding of things is so different, and how grateful I am for that. But it took some time, you know? What it took was me taking ownership of my own part. Like at a certain point, I came to realize like, I am so privileged. I've had such a beautiful life. In fact, I am much worse than most of these people here because I made these choices with parents who loved me, a husband who loved me, children who were, I lived in one of the nicest places in the country in a very wealthy, beautiful, you know, place in Utah and right up by the mountain. And I still made these terrible choices. I made these choices where my own integrity was breached. And yet, most of these people have never had the opportunities I have. They were just surviving. How could I ever think that I was better than anybody in here? I'm not, you know. They're amazing people who have showed me such beauty and love. So,
and we're all connected.
You know,
we speak these words. We're all one, or we're all connected. We might go to a religious service. That message is clear. We might hear it on the internet. We might hear it from a TED talk or a book. Yeah. And those words can be really cheap.
Yeah.
Because we're all one. But then when the rubber hits the road and now you're in your situation in a federal high security prison, it gets real quickly that we are all connected, right? As you just mentioned, you are not better than them. They're not better than you. You're all humans trying to figure out this thing called life.
They are my people. I mean, I've met people out here as well that I love, but I remember having somebody say, oh, you should file for a pardon or clemency or whatever. And I said, oh, I'll never, ever do that. Like, I am standing with my people. I am super proud and honored to stand with the people I stand with. And when it comes to connection, try going somewhere for almost 5 years with no phone, no internet, no device. You can't even go to Africa and get away from that. Everyone has it. Homeless people have phones, right? So to be in a place where there's no technology, and we literally, somebody comes down to the library, and I worked in education and they have to do an assignment. So I pull out the encyclopedia and we look it up together. And a lot of them can't read. So we write it and we sound out the words together. Or, you know, they're going through pain. So they come and sit next to me on a bench and we have this conversation. I've never felt so connected to everybody around me as I did in prison, to the point where I remember a volunteer coming in once and standing there kind of nervous. And I looked at the volunteer and I thought, they have no idea who we are. Like, they were looking at people walking through the halls with tattoos that look big. And I thought, you don't know her. She's the kindest little soul ever. Like, once you really get to know people in that close of quarters, you're all equal. We all wore the same clothes. I mean, what a beautiful experience to realize there is nothing that differentiates us. You know, we're all the same and we are truly all connected through love. Through love, we're all connected.
So one storyline, when people are sent to prison, it's we're going to send them to prison and they'll be rehabilitated and become good public citizens. You know, it's right. almost like the Shawshank Redemption line of the movie. Like you did your crime, you'll do your time, but in prison we'll rehabilitate you into a better human and we'll bring you out into society. How do you respond to that storyline based on your experience?
Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. There's a benefit to being in prison, and that's protection, the safety of it. I don't depend on the system ever to rehabilitate anybody. I don't believe that that is within their power. I believe in the people that are in prison. I believe in their goodness. So if we want to do something as a society, we need to start seeing people as who they are, these incredible, strong, brave souls who have come from nothing, the hardest circumstances, and who are fighting their way, gritting their way out. And when you see that, when you see this girl that's been traumatized beyond anything you could comprehend, come down and thank me for helping her write a resume and tell me how scared she is to leave. Or when you see an officer in prison who I actually really looked up to, and she looked at me and said, I'm so scared to send these girls out. What they have to go back to is so scary for them. We can keep them safe here. You know, it's backwards. Nobody understands that these people are brave and strong. And when we start seeing that and giving them opportunities, when we start seeing it the right way, yeah, that's where our power lies, not in trying to rehabilitate anyone. We just need to recognize their humanity. And then everything will be okay. Because they responded to that. They responded to my love and recognition of their humanity. I mean, literally the day I walked out of prison, the whole compound came cheering me on, ran out after me and chased me out the compound. We love you, Miss Louder. They loved me. I wrote my first book because I loved them so much. I was like, we have to tell this story. You know, I never felt so loved and supported as I did in prison. People were so desperate for what I could give them because I had a little bit of strength and a little bit of education, a little bit more that I could provide for them. And they were grateful for every ounce of it. And when I got to a place where I could see their humanity, wow, they rose to that. Yeah. That's what we can do for people in prison.
Yeah, that's so beautiful, Portia.
All right. Now feels like a good moment to pause, breathe, reflect. And when we come back, Portia will share what she discovered about how we're living after she left prison and the work she's doing today to help us heal and connect with each other. So wherever you happen to be, come into a dignified posture. You can close your eyes if you like. And we'll connect with the breath. So let's drop in. We'll begin with a healthy breath in. If you can, breathe up through your nose. And offer your attention to the breath, placing your focus on wherever you feel the breath most clearly. And releasing the breath, and as you do, relaxing into this moment. Nice full breath in. And a relaxing breath out. Now let's do one more together. Full breath in. And a releasing breath out. All right. Nice job. You just took a moment to pause, breathe, reflect. And when you download our app, you'll find hundreds of other practices that can help you live thoughtfully and happier and bring more meaning to your life. So take a moment today to download our app, either from Apple's App Store or Google Play, and join our like-hearted community. Now, let's go back to Portia's story and what she discovered about how we were living while she was in prison.
you went into prison at an interesting period in our history, mainly around technology.
Yeah.
You know, these little phones, they popped up, I forget when, but they popped into our lives.
Right.
So you went off to prison.
About the time I left. Bam, bam, bam.
Around 2015, and then you come out around 2020, right?
Right.
What did you notice about us on the other side of prison, like how we were living? You share a story about taking a flight when you went from the federal prison system, the high security facility, to more like, I'm still having a hard time processing this word, a camp.
Which camp, they call it a prison camp.
Yeah, to me, it's like, I don't think it's camp. You know, like camp for me is like
not that kind of camp.
A bow in a lake and s'mores, and you're going to a prison camp. But you went there first. That was your first, I think, exposure to the outside world. But then when you finally came out of the prison system, what did you notice about how we were living with our phones, with each other, with ourselves? I would love for you to share more about that.
Well, it was such a surprise to me. I mean, I had been in this enclosed environment where everything was connection. I mean, you eat at tables with each other, you sleep by each other, you're waiting in line at the shower to get in the shower. I mean, there's this, everything's connection. You go for a walk outside together, and I get on an airplane, and there's two guys sitting next to me, and both of them didn't even say hello. I mean, they had their phones the entire time, and I was like, so surprised they didn't want to ask me who I was or have a conversation, because anyone that comes into prison, you're going to say, hey, where are you from? You're going to ask that. Like, nobody would ever do that in prison. If you're reading a book and someone sits down, oh, hi, are you new? You know? So I was just like, I don't want to be here. I was relieved when I got, you know, I landed, tell a taxi driver, can you take me to the prison? It was so funny because his response was, why are you going to the prison? And I said, that's where I live. Well, there's only bad people there. I said, well, I'm going there. Uh-oh. I hope not, because that's where I live. But and he was really sweet when he got me there. He, like, call me anytime. You're a lot different than I would have thought someone going to prison would be. But I felt relieved when I walked in. I was like, I'm back. My people. I'm safe. Like, the outside world is scary, you know? And it took me a while when I got home to find people that I can connect with the way that I connected out there. So, and part of that is like the conversation we're having today, right? I mean, this is why I'm doing this. I feel connected to you, and I'm able to, I'm stubborn. So it didn't take me long after I got home to decide, I really don't care what anyone thinks or what anyone says. I'm gonna just do life the way I'm comfortable doing it. And that's being very open, because that's what I did in prison. It made me happy. So, you
absolutely
know.
Absolutely. And I'm right there with you on the weirdness of getting on an airplane and coming into your row, and two people are already there, and you sit down, and no one even acknowledges you. It is this is a clean podcast, but it's so freaking bizarre. It's like, like,
and rude. Pull your head, like,
pull your head up from your phone, and just,
right,
even if it's just a simple nod, like, hey, I see you, roommate,
right?
Or, hey, how you doing? We don't necessarily need to get into a full-on conversation about our histories and where are we from and where we're going, although that's really nice and very pleasant. But at least
acknowledge,
I think flying, if we just did this, for anyone taking, you know, maybe they're on a plane right now listening to this, but say hi to the people that you're, like, near. Like, just acknowledge them. I think it would make flying at least, like, marginally better, as opposed to sending...
It makes life better.
Yeah.
I mean,
come on.
I go to the store, and someone's in front of me, and I'm like, hey, how are you? If there's a little, you know... You pull up to the drive-thru or whatever, and you say, hey, how are you doing today? It just makes life better, you know? But it's this stupid phone. Like, it really disconnects you. It can be a great device to connect as well. I mean, there's good things about it, but don't ever forget this, you know, we're human. We're connected. We're all together in this, and we need each other.
Yeah, it's not who you are. It's simply a tool. Because the phone or the computer brought us together. So we can thank technology for taking these two humans right now, having this conversation about your story mm-hmm. and about connection. We can thank technology for bringing us together.
Yeah.
But then we tend to overdo it. Like we take something good and was like, okay, if like 10 is good, then 1,000's even better. And then we just like drop into our phone and we can't mm-hmm. pull ourselves away from it. We can't put the phone down, as I like to say. So I'm right there with you. So everyone listening, please just look around to your left, to your right, and say hello to someone on your flight and try to make a connection. You never know who you might meet. So now we're going to come to the show and tell part of the show, Marcia.
Okay.
So this is my Kintsugi bowl. So for people out there that don't know Kintsugi, so the pottery starts out pretty nice, right? No flaws, no blemishes. But then when the pottery breaks, they put it back together. And they use a glue called Urishi. Mm-hmm. And then they dust the Urishi with gold. Hence the name, the Golden Repair. So instead of trying to hide our scars, our blemishes, we highlight them as golden symbols of our strength and resilience. That's what I love about your story. At least one part of your story. There's so much to love about your story. So when you think about connection, for the person out there listening who may be just in awe of your story and your stubbornness and your grit and your tenacity to get through what you've gone through and find a way to connect with yourself and heal and connect with others, but they still may have a hard time relating to being in the federal prison system.
Sure.
What advice would you have for them in terms of them trying to find their own Urishi, their own glue, to have more connection mm-hmm. in their lives? What did you discover about what it takes to connect that you would wish to offer to others as some friendly counsel or advice?
It's not our perfections that connect us. It's our weaknesses. And
it's all of our blemishes, right?
It is. And I think that I had spent so much time trying to be perfect and overcome things. And in a way, my sentence was freeing to me. It freed me because who cares anymore? You know, I walked out of that courthouse and the news was standing there. And so I literally was on the 10 o'clock news that night. And the next day I wrote a post and I posted it on Facebook and it just said, I'm devastated. I'm leaving my family for 7 years. I knew I made mistakes. I didn't expect this sentence, but it's here. Please support my family. I probably deserve anything that you would think of me. But my children and my husband, they need support. And the outpouring of love and compassion was incredible. But it wasn't because I reached out and said, you know, it was because I reached out in humility and weakness. And I think when we do that, people respond. And vulnerability, I'm so grateful that for the love and support of others. But I truly believe that people want to support us. And if we put up the wall of perfection, it's impossible. And so it's okay that we're all struggling. It's actually brings us together and we can help each other through it. So
yeah, we're all going through something. We tend to put on our body armor and pretend that, we got this. Nothing here to see. We're all good. And meanwhile, deep down inside, we're all going through something. One thing I'm coming away from our conversation with is this whole concept of freedom. You've referenced it a couple times in our conversation. Of course, when you go into prison, you lose some freedom. You lose a lot of freedom. But you also found your freedom, and how you reference that there are many people who are not in prison walking around the streets today who are actually in prison. An internal prison. And
I see it different. I think I lost my liberty when I walked into prison and I found myself and I found freedom.
Yeah.
And like so, you know, you could be in any circumstance and you can be very free. I found freedom in my response to what was happening around me, in my thoughts. As I opened my soul to others, I found connection and freedom. I felt very free. And by the end of my sentence, I never liked myself so much. I remember looking in the mirror. I was proud of the woman I had become. And I learned I didn't need a man. I didn't need more money. I didn't need more drugs. I just needed to know who I am. And I found myself. And that was worth every difficult step of that journey. And I believe that whatever journey your listeners are on, whatever challenge they're facing, because there's so many, there's something so beautiful on the other side. And it's actually walking through that journey that will help you come to know who you are and why you're on this earth. And that has been the case for me. And I'm so grateful for that. And it's come through connection, conversations, coming to know who I am. It's come through walking through pain too. And how blessed I feel like I am because of that journey.
So. I love the fact that you've taken all that you've been through. And even though you've been really eloquent in sharing and really clear in sharing your story even further in your books, okay, no one can truly appreciate what you went through except for you, right? Yeah. And but we do have empathy and a sense because of what you just shared today of what you've gone through. And I so appreciate you sharing your story here and really being a role model for all of us, because we're all going through something, and how you took what was a long period of struggle going back to even when you were a teenager, and now you're turning that mud. There's a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, a meditation teacher, no mud, no lotus, that sometimes we have to go through the muddy stuff in life, the muddy moments, the tough moments that we just want to get out of in order for the lotus to blossom, because the lotus on that lily pad in the pond has to grow through the muck and the dark and the dank and all that. And you really do embody our Kintsugi spirit. And I just want to thank you, Portia, for sharing your story in such a raw and vulnerable and powerful way to help others today.
Thank you, Michael. Such a pleasure to be with you today and with your viewers. So grateful and honored for the opportunity. Yeah.
Is there anything I didn't ask you but should have?
No, I just... Again, I want to just let your viewers know that your love and view of humanity makes a difference. Your presence makes a difference. Just the fact that you're listening to this podcast, and if you're listening to my story and you have any compassion for me, I would say have more for the people that I met in prison. And I am just grateful that people care, you know, that they care, because your care and your love, again, your compassion and your willingness to reach outside yourself makes a difference to humanity, makes a difference for me. I have been very blessed to come home and be so loved and supported. And everyone out there can do that for everyone that they meet when they come home from prison. You know, give them a shot. Believe that people can change and that they want to, that they're desperate to, and that your view of them makes a difference. So,
I so appreciate you, Portia. So, and I'm super grateful that we're connected. So thanks for joining me.
What an incredible story. Her grit, her ability to endure, her ability to heal and connect. And now she's taking that moment that changed her life and helping others. That is definitely part of our Kintsugi spirit here. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Portia. And I hope you'll check out her book and the other ways you can connect with her. I'll put all that in the show notes. And when you do connect with her, please let her know that you heard about her through the Kintsugi podcast. And Portia, thank you for joining me. You're an inspiration. And I just love the ripple that you're putting into the world. And for you, I want to say thank you, because I know time is your most precious resource. We can't make any more of it. So the fact that you decided to spend some of your time here with us in our community means the world to me. You make our community stronger. So thank you. And if you haven't already left a kind review for the podcast, I hope you'll do that today. And don't forget about downloading your Pause, Breathe, Reflect app to help you bring more happiness to your life. And until next week's episode, another story of connection. Remember, when you meet a challenging moment, slow things down and come back to your breath. And know that you've got this and we've got you. And together, we'll put a beautiful ripple into the world. And continue to celebrate our scars as golden symbols of our strength and resilience. I love you. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you next week. This episode is brought to you by Pause, Breathe, Reflect, the app that can help bring more mindfulness to your everyday moments. Imagine what would be possible if more people could live more mindfully.